kids. Matt Segundo here, and I'm feeling very concerned about my legacy. You see, much like the purported great man in Kate Christensen's new book, two biographers have approached my friends and family to dig up dirt. One prospective biography, entitled Bat Segundo, A Cautionary Parable for the Radio Industry, purports to reveal to the world the size of a certain anatomical appendage. They apparently have unimpeachable evidence, but they're liars, I tell you. The other, Blind as a Bat, Segundo, A Case Study, is a more journalistic take that reveals the number of times I apparently, fiddle with something each day. These are troubling developments for any public figure, but I will happily challenge any and all claims. Just lay them down.
So I'm here with Kate Christensen, who is the author of In the Drink, The Epicure's Lament, and most recently, The Great Man. Kate, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. Actually, this is the first podcast I've done without laryngitis, so I'm very happy about that, but you're the first of that nature. I wanted to actually ask you about this book in relation to your previous novels. I mean, your previous novels have had these out-of-control, wild protagonists that are the center of the narrative. Now, in this particular novel, the center character is actually dead, and so all these characters come from the periphery. So why did you decide upon having sort of the great sort of figure, the sort of hurricane eye, so to speak, actually be dead this time around?
Well, he didn't interest me so much as a first-person narrator. I mean, you could say he has certain things in common with Claudia and In the Drink, and Hugo, especially in The Epicure's Lament, in that he can say whatever he wants, and he's sort of a loose cannon in a way. He has a lot of opinions, and he's a man of excess appetites, like all my earlier narrators. But he was successful and therefore not interesting to me as a first-person narrator. My first-person narrators tend to be losers, and they're the kind of people whose heads I like to get in and who I like to have take over my brain. That entertains me deeply. But Oscar, on the other hand, was successful. He played the game. He was a schmoozer. He was a bad boy, but he got everything he wanted in life and therefore was somewhat two-dimensional. And so I like to write about peripheral characters. And that's something all my first-person narrators have in common, I think, is that they're all peripheral to society in a way that makes them able to say whatever the hell they want, which appeals to me as their creator, to let them sort of take over my brain and run the show and dictate the entire novel to me as I sit and type it.
Hugo and Oscar, I actually want to compare them. First of all, they both are named after awards. So, you know, Hugo science fiction, Oscar film. Second, actually, Hugo was actually in the process of dying in The Epicure's Lament. Now you have a dead man. So what is the sort of, what's going on here?
Well, and you could also say that all the women who are peripheral to Oscar are in the process of dying in a real way. I mean, yeah. Hugo was suicidal. I guess I'm obsessed with death like anyone else. I mean, that's the easy answer. I wrote The Epicure's Lament right after I turned 40, and I was having what you might call a midlife crisis. I finally became aware for the first time of my own mortality in a way that I hadn't been in my 30s. And turning 40, I suddenly woke up and looked over the hill and saw the other side, and the other side was death. And that's where we're all headed. And it seems like a reality now in my writing in a way that in my first two novels, which I wrote in my 30s, I wasn't aware of it in the same way. I was more aware of being young and struggling, and something really happened after I turned 40. I think a switch went off in my brain, and I realized we're all going to die.
But in this case, you sort of took the hypothetical sort of slide ruler and slid it to like the 60s and the 80s and the 70s. So why did you, dwell upon this latter age bracket?
Well, I mean, there's no easy answer. It's not like I choose my characters. They're sort of thrust upon me by some instinctual need to write about a certain kind of person. I started writing chapter one about Henry and Teddy, the mistress and one of the two biographers. A long time before I wrote the novel, I just sort of wrote it on a whim one day. I was trying to write something else and it wasn't working, and I just turned to that scene with the young biographer who's 40 arriving at the home of a 74-year-old mistress of a dead painter. And there was something about that dynamic that appealed to me immediately. I thought it was interesting that she seemed to have all the power as an older woman. And I was conscious as I was writing that initial chapter that I wanted her to not be the stereotypical. I try and try and try to get away from stereotype. I have a real revulsion for it and a sort of natural a kind of mischievous need to fight it. And so I wanted to make a sexy older woman who wasn't necessarily wise, who hadn't really learned everything, but who was sexual and still yearning and unfulfilled and uncompleted. And I find that characters like that are interesting. And I think all these older women in this novel are like my first person narrators, Jeremy and Hugo and Claudia, in that they didn't get everything they wanted. They have a lot left still to want in life, even though they're in their 70s and 80s. And that entertained me. I write to entertain myself primarily.
I noticed that the AARP actually highlighted this book for its use of older people and sexuality, and that's such an unusual thing to see in fiction. So I guess, was this an initial concern when actually drawing these characters out, or did that kind of come from this natural meeting that you started sort of writing about, or what?
I would say that, I write very viscerally and sort of instinctively, and I don't think that hard about what I'm writing. I try to write with my gut. And so I think I've observed in older women, my mother and her friends, and they're all now in their early 70s and late 60s, they're all very, they seem young. They seem not that much older than me emotionally, you know. I mean, they've been around longer, they have more memories, but they're still full of beans, and they're still, you know, and I think there are more older women like that than have been reflected in literature. I think it's a sort of gaping hole in the literary world of characters. Mary Wesley wrote some great novels about older women, and I love Miss Marple in the Agatha Christie novels, the older detective, but primarily I think older women have been depicted as past their prime and doddering and peripheral to the action, and old aunts that no one really wants anything to do with, or tedious grandmothers, or else the pious, wise, elder woman, you know, who saves the heroine with good advice. But they're never allowed to just screw up on their own account and have their own sort of stories be central.
Interesting too, because you have a sort of a marketplace of books that are devoted to the frolicsome sort of relationships of 20-somethings, and if we're lucky, 30-somethings. So that's what also makes it odd. Were you sort of combating, because I know that when In the Drink came out, it was, in my view anyway, unfairly sort of labeled as, oh, this must be chick lit because it has a 29-year-old protagonist.
Thank you. Yes, I agree. I was trying actually to write the female Lucky Jim. I thought, well, that hasn't been done. It wasn't an academic novel either. I mean, it was like the female urban Lucky Jim who keeps screwing up and like laughing at herself and has a kind of dark view of life. And in the end, she sort of has a happy ending in a way. Not as happy as Jim's. But then this isn't that same era. Now I'm trying to remember what your question was. Oh, yes. Somebody, I think my editor said jokingly that this novel is biddy lit. The old hens. But I think that this novel is, I don't know how to characterize it. I would call it a romantic comedy about women in their 70s and 80s.
Now, was this as unplanned as your other books in terms of writing it? You described this sort of wild writing process that you don't plan anything, you don't plot anything, and without that central character, this must have been a little bit more difficult for you.
Yes, it was. That's very perspicacious of you. Writing in the third person is completely different because instead of letting someone else's sensibility take over the novel, I'm in charge all of a sudden, and it's the first time I've done that, and I found it really, really difficult to accept my own authority as a narrator. And my first draft was 300 pages. I killed Maxine off in the middle. I handed it into my editor a year ago June, and he said, you know, I can't really finish reading this. I don't know whose novel it is. I don't know what you're doing. That was my attempt to write it instinctively without knowing where I was going. So I went home and spent last summer figuring out whose story it was, what structure it was going to have. I had to really think about this book in a way that my others didn't demand, because they were a voice carrying the whole story along, one person's sensibility. And I think when you have multiple sensibilities, you're far more responsible for a structure, a very cohesive and cogent structure.
Was this omniscient voice that you were approaching here for the first time, was this why you had some of these really lengthy, elaborate sort of imagery? I can actually quote a couple of things that I found, like, you have Katrina opening the door with the motion of her arm like a knife through water. You have chickpeas that look like round infant heads with cowlicks. And then even like the minor characters in this book have a remarkable amount of detail that I just don't usually see, like the waiter that's a slow-eyed, pale pre-Raphaelite beauty with a mole by his lush lower lip and a lock of curly dark hair on his forehead. Now, I have to ask you, under what circumstances did you feel compelled to have such, you know, I mean, that last sentence in particular reminds me very much of sort of a Richard Ford Stack sentence. So I'm wondering what circumstances caused you to just completely just go and just lay on these elaborately long sentences for this imagery?
I'm entertaining myself. It's fun. Really, that's the reason. I enjoy it. And it may be overindulgent or overripe, but I tend to like books and writers that have that kind of style. I tend to enjoy wordy, curly sentences that sort of go in a lot of directions, like certain vines, and it's often bear fruit that gets overripe very quickly. No, really, I it's fun. I think that's the kind. It's the kind of detail that I see in life as I'm looking at the world, and it's reflected, I guess, when I'm writing a scene and I'm trying to envision it and transfer what I see to the page. It tends to take that sort of elaborate form.
Is there a danger, though, in terms of doing that, you might actually fall into sort of Fowler's elegant variation or anything? Or?
What do you mean?
Well, like this sort of like, you know, he described the elegant variation as this sort of like needlessly ornate kind of sentence that's trying to be clever. Is that sort of a danger with delving into these things? I mean, and why did they come? Why do you think they came so much more in omniscient voice than in first person?
I don't know. Do they? I mean, I think about Hugo and some of his observations that are completely over the top. And I think that I'm not so sure. I think that kind of writing pervades all of my novels, for better or worse. And it's possibly a self-indulgence, but I think it's also a matter of taste. I mean, I think if you do it right, it can work. And if you do it wrong, you do it wrong. But I'm taking that risk, I think, instinctively, on purpose.
One thing I have to ask you about, speaking of the imagery in this book, there is a good deal of exquisite depictions of food scattered throughout the text. And in fact, at one point, you actually have Abigail quite literally consider the oyster. So I have to ask, is this sort of an additional problem of being a novelist who is perhaps too drawn almost to M.F.K. Fisher, that the influence rubs off on the text like that?
I think that I'm passionate about food. I love M.F.K. Fisher, but I think that she really pervaded the Epicure's Lament. In a way, she and Montaigne were sort of the household saints of that novel. And I think with this novel, I'm really mad about food and in my life. And I like reading and writing about food almost as much as I like cooking and eating. And I think that the word part of my brain and the food part of my brain are intertwined in some way that I've discovered through my life. Not everyone is wired that way, which was a shock when I realized that. But I'm the kind of person who will read about food and have to eat what I'm reading immediately. And reading M.F.K. Fisher has forced me to go out and buy ingredients I wouldn't ordinarily buy and cook them. So, I mean, I feel like she definitely has taken up residence in my brain forever. And I'm grateful for that. I like having her in there. She's very different from me in that she's far more confident and arrogant than I am. And but again, I am entertaining myself with these descriptions of food. I'm sort of sitting there. And in The Great Man, I hadn't made any of those recipes. I sort of invented them on the page. They're very much literary inventions. But then this summer, I started wondering what all that food tasted like, and I started cooking my way through the novel. And I've made every single dish now in the novel.
Wow. I was going to ask if you would just basically you were really hungry when you started sitting down to write or something.
Always hungry.
I also wanted to actually ask you about sort of the food and flower descriptions that are within all of the decor of the characters' apartments. It seemed to me this kind of, you know, and maybe this was planned or maybe this was not planned, it almost reflected the nature of sort of having still objects within a sort of portrait of a nude painting or anything like this. Was this something that you were really trying to do throughout the entire atmosphere of the book? Because they're all over the place. And every single time there's a meeting, there's always this sort of arrangement of, oh, what are we going to actually cook? In a way that I just have never really seen. I mean, if it makes me want to be a biographer, as a matter of fact.
Well, again, I think this is taking up where the Epicure's Lament left off, also in terms of food, not only death. I think that Hugo was someone who used food to tie himself to life, although he was trying to kill himself throughout the Epicure's Lament. He really didn't want to die, and the food provided for me, as the writer, the clue to the fact that he didn't want to die. He didn't want to kill himself. I wanted him to die throughout the novel, but...
You wanted Maxine to die, too.
Yeah, I know, and I wasn't able to kill her off either until the end. But finally someone does die in one of my novels. But in this novel, I think that food is... old women are very isolated, and I think that their lives have a tendency to have become attenuated and not, you know, I want to say peripheral, but maybe more solitary, because their kids are gone, their careers are over, their husbands and lovers are dead, and they are pretty much alone in their houses. And food is the mechanism, along with the biographers, that sets up these meetings. It sort of undergirds the plot in a way. It's integral to the story because there's an activity to be done, not only talking about Oscar, but eating around Oscar, I think. And I find that food can say a lot about the people who are cooking and ordering it. What you order, like the oysters at the end, when Lila and Abigail are on their date, and they realize that this is like a romance for them. They would rather have a new friend than a new boyfriend at this point in their lives, and they order oysters. And Abigail is a conservative Jew who tries to keep kosher, and Lila says, "Oh, right, you're Jewish, I'm so sorry." She had ordered the oysters, and Abigail eats them anyway, which is a kind of clandestine, tryst-like thing to do. So to me, it sort of signifies that she's willing to go beyond herself to be friends with Lila, that there's some new shoot growing in her. That was the feeling I got when I wrote the scene, but I didn't consider it cerebrally. It just made sense to me.
But if you're kosher all your life, you're not just going to suddenly eat meat like that.
No, she says she tries to keep kosher, but she loves oysters because she's not Orthodox. She's conservative, which I've known a lot of conservative Jews who have sort of been kosher at home but not in a restaurant, etc. I mean, I've seen a lot of my friends who were raised conservative have made allowances in restaurants and other people's houses. So I kind of copied that for Abigail.
I wanted to, haven't really touched on Maxine, and I actually wanted to ask you about her because she seems rather spry and energetic for someone who's 84. And not only that, but you know, she sits there and completely chain smokes, but there's no, as is noted in the book, no emphysema, no cancer, not even a hacking cough. This seems a little bit sort of, I guess, heightened or preternatural. I was wondering if there was any specific sort of person you modeled Maxine after or anything like that.
I modeled Maxine after my husband's third cousins, I think they are, or second cousins, who went through the Holocaust. And they're a bunch of tough old Jews. They are the toughest old birds I've ever met in my life. They are the largest surviving intact group of siblings. Seven of them came through the concentration camps together. And I met them, and I'm not Jewish. And when John and I were engaged, so to speak, I mean, we were planning on getting married. He introduced me to he called them his uncles and aunts, his Uncle Alex. And Alex took one look at me and said, "Is she Jewish?" to John, and John said, "No." And he said, "Well, that's three strikes against her." He ended up loving me. We got pretty close. But they were amazing. They were all in their 80s, and they were all tough. None of them had any health problems, and they all were determinedly, like, tough-minded. And, you know, any small ailment, I guess, after the concentration camps, you can sort of poo-poo. So yeah, she was definitely based on, I imagine she came from their kind of stock, from the same shtetl that they came from.
84 though, I mean, running around and pacing around the studio, that's, you know, I was reading this going, well, come on, you know, it's a little bit on the heightened side.
Hey, my grandmother also was in her 90s, as spry as Maxine, at 93. She died of the flu, but she was ready to keep going. She didn't want to die. And she had absolutely nothing slowed her down.
We haven't actually talked even about the sort of patriarchal trappings of this book. Again, wanting to ask you about the sort of nature of the spontaneous narrative versus the planned narrative. There's this interesting sort of patriarchal tone I kept noticing, and again, very much underneath the text. You have Oscar painting the nudes. You describe Henry in the very beginning as the kind of young man you saw everywhere these days, gutless and bland, and then you describe Benny, Lewis's driver, as he gave the impression of being either prepubescent or unable to grow whiskers. Now, that to me is a very sort of old world versus new world sort of mentality, a comparison of masculinity just underneath the surface, and I wanted to actually ask you about the kind of emasculated sort of tone of a lot of these male characters. How did this, I mean, you know, was this again just having fun or what?
Are you saying that you think that I denigrate the male characters in the novel? I want to be clear what you're asking before I answer it.
I actually happen to like the fact that you denigrate some of the male characters. I'm just curious as to how it kind of originated from.
I'm not sure. I think it's a good question. It was largely unconscious, but I think that I have a tendency to sort of poke, sometimes gentle, sometimes sharp, fun in one character's mind at another character. So it's not me making fun of these characters. I'm seeing Benny through Teddy's eyes and seeing how she might see him. And she is someone who does not romanticize men. She's someone who sees him with a gimlet eye, loves him anyway, but has no idea, you know, I mean, Oscar she thought was the person she liked the most in her entire life, but she thought he was the biggest baby in the history of humankind, and the furthest thing from a genius that she had ever known. So she's very, say, clear-eyed when it comes to looking at men. Ditto Maxine, a lesbian, who saw her brother, you know, who says her brother had a small penis. She tells that to Ralph. So I think there is a way in which women do look at men, certain women do look at men, in a kind of indulgent yet gimlet-eyed, I think is the best way to describe it, manner.
Well, even slow-eyed.
Because the waiter is looking that way too, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, that's Abigail seeing the waiter, and she's noticing something a little bit different. She's noticing that his beauty was designed to appeal to a different sex from hers.
Okay, so these are actually sort of interesting to me because they came across because this is the problem, I suppose, sometimes of omniscient voice, because I'm thinking to myself, oh, there's this overarching sort of, you know, stabbing at patriarchy, when in fact you're trying to reveal from the point of view of the character.
But I think maybe through my characters, I am getting at something larger. I mean, it's been called a feminist novel, and I tend to bristle at the word feminist because I think it implies something didactic and two-dimensional. But it's feminist in the sense of it's reflecting a reality that I've observed in not just past generations, but even now, in terms of male and female artists and men and women's relationships. And it does seem that men get to get away with being a lot more bad than women. Even now, even today, more ambitious, more extreme, more outspoken. And I think one of the things that made me want to write The Epicure's Lament was being able to inhabit a male point of view and say things that as a woman I just really can't say. If he had been a female character, it probably would have been called chick lit. I don't know.
We need dick lit, that's what we need.
Dick lit.
I wanted to actually ask you about the sort of antipodean characters you have in both The Biographers and in Teddy versus Abigail. They both inhabit total extremes. You have it with Teddy as this bohemian, unattached, free-loving kind of gal. And you have Abigail, who's more pragmatic. Henry is this sort of unhappily domesticated, straight, by-the-book sort of guy. And then you have, he's white. And then you have, as if it weren't clear enough, you have Ralph. He's African-American. He's gay. He's more, I suppose, sensual to a certain degree. And I wanted to ask you about this. Did you need to kind of give yourself sort of this great kind of spectrum of two polar extremes to kind of perpetuate all of the conflict? Or how did this kind of come about?
It came about, well, the two biographers came about because I had two different beginnings of the novel. I also wrote a chapter with Ralph and Teddy, thinking that I would change the biographer. And so after I had reread the first chapter, after I'd written it, I thought, oh, this could be a novel. I like Teddy. I'm not so sure about Henry. Let me try with a different kind of biographer. So then I invented Ralph as a different kind of biographer to Henry to try and see what that would be like. And then I realized, hey, I like the dramatic tension of two biographers. That was sort of the thing that set the novel in motion for me. Two biographers, that makes it much more interesting. They can uncover different things about Oscar. They can be competing. And the wife and mistress, that was there from the beginning because initially Teddy was the mistress, which implies a wife, which implies another duality. And then there are her twin daughters. I mean, there are so many dualities in this novel that were largely just, I think I threw them in there for dramatic tension because I like the idea of pitting one thing against another and the way that throws the other one into relief by contrast. And by the end, when I realized, as I was running the last scene with the two paintings, the two biographers, the wife and the mistress, the twin sisters, the brother and sister painters, all of them together at the end at Maxine's retrospective, that was when it really hit me. Oh my God, there's really a lot of duality in this novel, but I didn't conceive it that way.
Noah's Ark or something.
It's Noah's Ark.
Well, I mean, but why, you know, too, there are more twins in this book than any of your other books.
I know, this is my twin book. I don't know how that happened. Everyone else is such an individual cuss in my other novels. Everyone seems to be solitary and alone. This is, again, a comedy. I think when I decided to give it a structure, I chose a classical comedic structure with everyone paired off at the end, like in Midsummer Night's Dream. So, and that implies also people pairing off another Noah's Ark thing. But again, I think it really arose naturally in some way, just instinctively, within the structure that I had set up in my own mind. I actually pictured the four women as being opposite each other, you know, Abigail, Teddy, Lila, and Maxine. And the two biographers sort of circling around them like bees around flowers. That was my image, and Oscar the sun shining down on them. I know it's a hokey image, but that's what I began the book with.
It's interesting because I talked to Julia Glass about her last book, and she also populated her book with twins. And a lot of it had to do with this kind, and she also had a lot of food imagery in there. I'm wondering if it's accessing some particular light comedic type of structure that causes twins to sort of propagate.
Yeah, maybe it's some sort of literary, like, fertility drug or something.
I want to actually ask about the nature of poetry in this book. You have Henry constantly sort of reciting this fictitious poet, Greta Church, and he sees this deeper meaning that nobody else can. As well as you also open the book with Philip Larkin's The Old Fools, and I'm wondering if this was kind of your way of sort of saying, well, you know, we don't necessarily have to be so deconstructive about poetry, and that the actual deconstructive, the quest for finding meaning in everything, is the downfall of all of these particular characters.
That's so well put. That's exactly what I was trying to do. That's exactly what I was trying to do with Greta Church and with sort of Henry's insistence that everyone love her poetry and that he get to recite it wherever he goes and feeling like he needs to resurrect this woman. But for me, the scene where his whole Greta Church thing really reaches its climax is when he's in the car with Ethan and Abigail on the way down to Maxine's, and he starts comparing Ethan to a statue of Jesus down in Chiapas and a poem that Greta Church wrote about it that goes, there is a thing that's not a thing that is a thing itself, you know, and on and on and on, like kind of like a Gertrude Stein on crack or something. And it's, to me, I laughed out loud when I was writing that, just from his desire to imbue everything with a kind of heavy symbolic freight. And Ethan is a blank slate, and he's projecting onto him. And I think that's sort of I was poking a little bit of fun at a certain type of poetry lover or art lover who tends to sort of try to see symbolic meaning everywhere he or she goes.
Or even attach it within a oeuvre, because you have like the whole, you know, scenario with one of the paintings that, without giving it away, where the sort of provenance is sort of in question.
Yeah, so we don't want to give it away by...
Well, I guess I sort of have given it away, but essentially one of the paintings, the provenance is in question, and yet these biographers are placing it upon sort of great levels of where it actually represents Oscar's, where it could be found in Oscar's career. I mean, is... Going back to sort of the other observation I had made about like the still objects in the environment, sort of reflecting the still objects in the paintings, is this essentially kind of, I guess, is there some sort of, are you trying to portray the dangers of examining things too closely so that, you know, one totally is unable to actually sort of exist or, you know, in life or enjoy things like food?
Well, I think that art and poetry have both become so rarefied and so removed from daily life now. I mean, they've gone in this academic direction in which, you know, people think much too much about it. It's very cerebral and not so visceral anymore. And I feel like Abigail does, that she said she couldn't study literature, although I did study literature and loved it and loved being analytical, but she said reading a book like Jude the Obscure, she just felt so strongly, sympathetically toward all the characters and was interested in them as people. And to me, that's the way to appreciate art. And so I think that I was trying to get at us. Again, here's another dichotomy, the cerebral versus visceral. It's like the argument that Maxine has with Paula Jabbar at the dinner party, where she's saying conceptual art is a lot of clever hoo-ha, and I don't write. I write from my gut. I mean, I paint from my gut. That's an interesting slip I just made, because I wish I were a painter. But I paint from my gut. I paint, you know, what I'm feeling. I'm not, you know, engaging in a dialogue with, you know, anybody or... So to me, that's like a classical shift, not classical, it's a contemporary shift in painting and poetry, away from a kind of relationship with the world and with your own sort of gut feelings, into this cerebral sort of, you know, rarefied academic kind of atmosphere.
But isn't there a certain danger? I mean, we were talking about these people who are looking at The Great Man as a feminist novel. What if they take your book too seriously? Are they not allowed to do that? Or, I mean, you know, what's the deal there?
Oh, they're welcome to do whatever they want with it. I mean, I can't control the way people see my work. Call it chick lit, call it feminist. No, I don't know. I have no control over it. But I wanted to get back to the whole feminist question anyway, because I think that I got on a tangent. And what I wanted to say was, I was trying to write about something that I think is real, and I think that it is a feminist idea that male artists are given far more respect than women, than female artists. The same way male writers tend to get a lot more respect than female writers. It's much harder as a female writer to be taken seriously. And so you can't possibly take my writing too seriously. But I was trying to get at that with Maxine and Oscar and their duality, and that's sort of the contrast between a very serious female painter who's painting sort of in a more visceral vein, not visceral, but a more sort of, what is the word? I don't know how to characterize her painting vis-a-vis Oscar's. But I think Oscar had a shtick and Maxine didn't. I think that she was more sort of genuinely trying to explore paint and the possibilities of abstraction, and he was trying to fuck a lot of women. But he was more famous and more successful, although she was arguably a greater painter.
But here's the thing about designing a novel this way. I mean, here you are approaching it viscerally and yet also approaching it with constructs. So what is the relationship between the visceral, feral charge of writing and implementing all of these little constructs and these little taxonomies and these twins, for example?
Well, I would say that a lot of these things arise viscerally. I think that I had my 300-page first draft last June that was a complete visceral mess, and I had to impose some order on it. So that was something that I had to force myself to do. It wasn't what came naturally in writing the novel, but I realized that the novel required me to muster my authority, so I did.
So you were really trying to up your game here in terms of the authority.
I was trying to up my game, that's very nicely put, yeah.
No, I mean, well, did you feel that you had gone everywhere you could with first-person novels for the first three, or?
Oh, no, not at all. But I did, I felt like this was going to be a different kind of novel. I mean, I think there's plenty left to do with the first person. I think it's sort of my natural swimming pool. But I did set out as a technical challenge for myself to write a third-person novel. Every other one of my novels has started in the third person, and then one person hijacks it and takes over, and then it turns into a first-person novel. And this one could have easily been Maxine's story or Teddy's story. I could have easily taken one of their voices. In fact, I longed to do it. I fantasized about doing it, but I didn't let myself, because I thought, okay, it's. I think I thought that writing a third-person novel was something that I just really had to do as a writer. It was a technique that I needed to explore, and so I forced myself, like flossing.
Yeah, but some writers out there, they will freely admit that all they can do is write in first person. I mean, why approach the third person? Just because you could do it? Or, you know, I mean, if you could have also hypothetically improved upon first person if you, like, told it from Maxine's perspective or the like.
Yeah, and I hope to write, my next novel will be first person. I hope to improve on what I've already done with the first person. There's plenty more to do. No, I just felt with this one that it was timed. I was kicking myself in the ass, partially. It was like, I think I had this crazy idea that it's more grown up to write a third-person novel. That it's somehow juvenile to write in the first person, which I no longer think.
Who cares about juvenile or adult, you know? Why did you bookend the book? Why did you bookend the novel with the two New York Times fictitious articles? Did you just, was this a kind of way to just play around or what?
Oh, yeah, just for the hell of it. I mean, it was really my editor's idea to do it, and I thought, why not? He said, well, I think we should, why don't you just write an obituary and see what happens with it? So I wrote the obituary, and he liked it and kept it. And then as I was nearing the end of the novel, he said, you know, what if you write the review of the two biographies? Just see what happens. Just write it. So I wrote it, and he liked it, and he kept them in the book. So that was all him.
One other construct I actually did not ask you about that I want to talk before we go is the sort of the racial overtones in this book. Oscar paints African Americans. At one point, Ralph says, "What isn't a cliche about black people when you get down to it?" Again, this seems to me a very sort of interesting duality, because you have essentially, like, you know,
are we going to label these as people, or are we going to label these as African American? You have a Jewish man painting African American. What of this? Was this another sort of, I guess, another twin, so to speak, that you wanted to play around with, or some larger social construct, or did it just, how did this come about? I mean, because it started, obviously, you mentioned you, the biographer, of, you know, kind of came out because you wanted to do something totally different. And I guess, how did that translate into just making this a more sort of predominant motif throughout the book?
Well, one of the biographers was black, and then there was this black woman in the painting. Right, there's the black woman and white woman in the two paintings, the black and white biographer, and then there's Paula Jabbar and Maxine, who are a black artist and a white artist. So I guess you're right, there is a sort of black-white duality throughout the novel. And I'm not sure what to say about that. I think that it's something that, again, reflects society to me. I mean, it's there are black people, there are white people, there are certain things that are called up. But as a white person writing about black people, I think I'm not entirely comfortable with it, I have to say. It was one of the aspects of the novel that I was least comfortable with. In terms of, I mean, at first, in my first draft, I really got into Ralph's head a lot more, and I let myself sort of, and that was very interesting. But then I had to narrow down the points of view. It just, that wasn't working, going into everybody's head, which is what I did in the first draft. But I found it really interesting. I found that I was seeing things through his eyes, seeing the way these people were talking about each other through his eyes, and it struck him as profoundly disloyal. And he was thinking about how his family would never be talking about each other that way. And then I started thinking, now is that a black thing, or is that Ralph's character? I don't know. It's tricky to write about race, and it's something that I haven't done a lot of, and I plan to do more of it and sort of really more deeply and more sort of thoughtfully.
Is that why you made him gay, so that you'd have some sort of, you know, angle there to kind of get inside his head? Or?
I didn't make him gay. He just was gay. You seem to think I have more control over all this than I do.
What control do you have over some of these qualities?
Well, I have control when something is written, but as I write, I try to strike a balance. I guess this is sort of what I'm saying. I'm trying to strike a balance between my controlling it and letting it have its own thing. And I think a lot of writers write this way, sort of allowing an organic unfolding unconsciously, letting the characters sort of take over and speak for themselves and have their own life and surprise you. And in order to do that, you have to abdicate a certain amount of control. So it's not that I have no control over what I'm doing, but I discovered there was something about Ralph in the first scene, with his funny dreadlocks and his way of talking and his non-attraction to Ruby, sitting at, that's Teddy's very sexy, beautiful daughter. And there's a scene where the conversation implies that maybe they're attracted to each other, and they're both embarrassed because they're not at all attracted to each other. And that just wrote itself. I didn't know where that came from. And then Abigail later guessed that he was gay, but I didn't really know it until she guessed it. And I'm not making this up. I mean, I think that seeing him through her eyes, I realized, oh, that's what it is. That he's gay. Uh-huh.
So I guess it seems to me, if I were to make a sort of judgment call here, that you're more of a sort of, I guess, responsive sort of writer, in the sense that one idea or one ball is in the air, and you essentially sort of go with that and are something of a stenographer on the page, and then you kind of make sense of these things later. I mean, where does the first ball come from then?
I know, that's interesting. The first, but it's like the Big Bang. Who knows? I think it comes from some sort of exchange of energy between two people. And in each of my novels, there's a tension between two people at the opening. In The Drink, it's between Claudia and Jackie, and that was obvious. I knew the novel was about that from the beginning. And in Jeremy Thrain, he's just had a one-night stand, and he's going home to his lover, who's closeted. So there's all this tension as the first chapter is rolling home, and as he goes home from his one-night stand, home to his lover, who's coming home with his wife, there's that tension. And the Epicure's Lament is Hugo's brother coming home, who he can't stand. And so there's that tension. And in this novel, it was Henry and Teddy. And I felt like making some mischief. And the only way I can make mischief in my life is to write. It never works if I do it in actual life. I try to be nice and behave. And so I just felt this sort of mischievous idea that I wanted to create some trouble on the page.
I mean, some of the times, though, I mean, one thing I actually wanted to ask you about is the sort of side characters, the minor characters, such as Lewis, the attorney. You know, he sort of appears early on, or even like the
Lila's boyfriend, who only appears at the very beginning, and then we never see him again. And you have this really specific detail about the fact that he wears this T-shirt that doesn't have a logo on it, which is absolutely, in my view anyway, pitch perfect. So I'm wondering, why do certain characters, I guess, pop up, have these great sort of flourishes of detail? I mean, is this part of the non-controlling impulse, or what happens here?
Well, I think this gets back to that question you're asking also about the detail that I imbue the waiter with, who just appears in one scene. But I think that's how I see people. I tend to apprehend them whole, even briefly, like a waiter in a restaurant. I think the word responsive really hit it on the head. I'm really watching people and trying to get as much as I can, figure them out as much as I can, even in a brief interaction, like on a subway or on the street or in a restaurant. I really try to take in a lot about that person, because this is my material, this is what I have.
Did you actually go to galleries or, like, you know, academic functions to kind of get a sense of what these biographers or these artists were like for the great man? Or?
You know, I go to a lot of openings. I have a lot of friends who are visual artists, but I would say that I really didn't draw from that when I wrote this novel. I think I kind of invented a parallel art world that is not exactly like the one that actually exists in New York. I think it's kind of a literary construct. I'm very familiar with painters and the art world, and I didn't do a lot of research for this book. I sort of made a lot of stuff up. Oscar's not based on anybody. Maxine's not based on anybody. Paula Jabbar's not based on anybody. And I sat there and invented it all.
Oscar's seduction of his best friend's wife, was this a way for you to, I guess, because the minute that we revealed this detail to the reader, or to this reader in particular, suddenly you know, okay, Oscar is this contemptible of a person. Did that detail come about because you felt like, as you were writing this, that, you know, again, Oscar is this sort of specter haunting the actual book, that people, again, are sort of, you know, dealing with the consequences of his actions? Did you feel that you needed to fill in his details? Did this come from your friendly editor who suggested the bookended New York Times articles, or what?
No, that was all me, that chapter. And again, that was something that was set in motion earlier, when the four women are sitting and talking, and Maxine says what a schmuck he is, and Abigail says, tell me, why? What kind of schmuck was he? And she said, well, you better ask his friend Mo Treitler. Now, I didn't know who Mo Treitler was, and I didn't know what Mo was going to say. And Mo showed up at Abigail's house and had this whole story, and that was Mo's story. And, I mean, it had to be something bad, because Maxine had implied that there was, like, a bad story about Oscar. And it's pretty much the worst thing you can do, I think. Well, aside from killing someone, maybe. But, you know, seducing your best friend's wife in a way that ends their marriage and then she dies of an overdose, yeah, it's pretty heinous. But I wanted to get at something about Oscar, and that is that he was so bad. He was such a bad boy. He was so selfish. He did whatever the hell he wanted. He denied himself nothing. And these women never held him to account. He got away with it completely. And he lost his best friend, and that was really the only person he lost through his bad behavior in his entire life. He's a kind of guy I think of as like the mid-20th century artist bad boy, kind of almost a stereotype, in that there was a romance about artists then that doesn't really exist anymore. That they really could get away with anything. And I was thinking that if he had gone into his father's butcher business and tried to be a womanizing, you know, male slut, he never would have gotten away with it. But because he was an artist...
Yeah, you made him a butcher to really sort of, I guess, come. And on that note, Kate, thanks very much. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
It's not a great idea. It's been in